Recorded live in Petone, New Zealand, this is the Cinematica Podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and all of the other episodes of the show, over 100 now, at cinematica.co.nz. Everybody to season 4, episode number 19 of Cinematica. I'm Dan Slevin, and joining me here in the Cinematica studio are
Kaylee
and me. Did you hear that? Something like the seagulls dropped something on the roof and then it's rolled along.
I just watched it fly off actually through the skylight. Yeah. It was a bit bigger than a seagull. I think it was an albatross actually, big giant wingspan.
I can just see the shadows on the wall of the birds.
Very Hitchcockian.
It is.
Yeah. It is. I didn't realise. I thought this was a safe zone.
No,
we're not safe.
No, and as we're going to find out a little bit later on, even Kaylee's house is not a safe zone after watching Stoker. So you had to come to work just to feel, secure.
Being around other people.
In today's episode, we're going to dismember the big current releases like Matt Damon in Elysium. As I mentioned a little bit earlier on, Park Chan-wook's Stoker. We'll talk about that. Coming of age is the topic of The Way, Way Back, and a different kind of growing up in Francis Ha. And also in the show, thanks to Rialto Entertainment, we've got some giveaways, so do stay tuned throughout the show, because we'll give you the opportunity to watch a couple of current releases on us and on Rialto. But first, time to look at what's in the mailbag. Kaylee.
Yes, Barnaby HM, who got one of our 2-for-1 tickets to Byzantium last week, said
he was so happy.
Yeah.
And said, has he?
I don't know.
Oh, okay.
But he did receive his ticket and said, thanks heaps, Cinematica. Yous are the best.
Wise words.
We are. Miriam Ruth Ross has a few two-word reviews for us this week. She's obviously been busy at the cinema. Her two-word review for Elysium is hyper-violent sci-fi. She also said, hate to do this because I love Park's Korean film so much, but my review of Stoker, whiny melodrama.
Yeah, there's going to be some mixed opinions about Stoker. Like some people, as we mentioned last week, some people are saying it's the best film of the year. Some not.
Yeah, I mean, Sarah Watt, a few weeks ago, she was film of the year for her, wasn't it?
Yeah.
And I had some people saying, they thought it was a bit of, vampires because of the name.
Yeah, that was something that I was led to, or I got the impression about as well, and no. But we'll be talking about that a little bit later on. What have people been going to see? Has Stoker managed to give the box office a nudge? What's our top five?
Well, in the number five position, still at number five, Despicable Me 2. In at number four, down from 2, The Wolverine. In at number 3, down from the number 1 spot, Now You See Me.
And that's interesting because that was such a huge film for its first week and first couple of weeks, and that's quite a big drop, isn't it, for something that was doing so well. And I noticed that a couple of cinemas are already announcing that it's going to be finishing today.
Yeah, but I think it's done better than the traditional first week drop off. You know, you get that first week and then bam.
Okay.
So it's hung in there all right, I reckon.
Yep.
Opening at number 2, We Are the Millers, and at number 1, Elysium.
Right.
Stoker is not on here.
No, hasn't made the top 20. Well, that's interesting.
Very limited release, though.
Yeah, it's very tight.
Yeah, and I saw some complaints from people, like no screens in Dunedin, for example, for Stoker. So, like, that's how limited it is. Is that it is just at very select locations, and also there was quite a lot of the people who would have been interested in it. And this is I wonder whether this is a kind of backfired strategy, that a lot of the people who are interested would have come to those sneaks, the weekend before.
I think that's very true. I mean. Does it create a buzz? Does it make people go and, does the word of mouth strong and people or does it actually just take a piece out of the market?
And that's the big gamble, isn't it? Whenever anybody releases a film is they think, oh, this is, if you're really super confident that it's a word of mouth film, then you do want people watching it early. But then, with Stoker, the word of mouth is it's sort of 50-50.
Yeah, and it's funny because I mean I remember the first film that I went to like that was Borat. You know, free screening, turn up, you know, limited seats, and they were turning, you know, it's just carnage. But it worked really well for that sort of film.
Yeah, it did, I wonder. I mean, that's always the argument about film festival screenings, isn't it? Is that, you know, that a film goes into the film festival, and even though it takes a certain amount of money out of the marketplace, it actually does kickstart, you know, the talk about a film. Like I can tell you that a film like Only Lovers Left Alive, which was the closing night film in Auckland and in Wellington, the buzz off that will be if it can be sustained through till Christmas when it comes out, will actually do it a lot of good, that film, much more so than if it hadn't played.
It's really funny because I mean there are some films that are, you know, come out of the festival, they're really strong and they take a while to get there and they kind of lose their momentum. Would that have happened anyway if they'd opened closer to the finishing date of the festival? You don't know. But then there are other films where the word is really beneficial and it just goes, you know, and the timing just feels right in terms of how the film opens afterwards. It is a very congested time post-festival with all the art product and what's coming out of it. And there are, there are titles that get released that probably have had the juice squeezed out of them and potentially shouldn't, but then, you know, a lot of cinemas probably shouldn't just take them if that's the case, if they think that. So but it does, you know, it's also the impact of people's spending habits and how they might have spent their lot at the festival and they're going to take a while to get back into it.
That's right. It does take a big, just in terms of pure dollars, you know, just does have that impact. I've got a question for you now, a piece of news that I missed a couple of weeks ago and it only sort of registered with me this week, and that is the choice of Icon, the international studio, to change their local distribution arrangements. They had been with Hoyts. Hoyts changed their name to Studio Canal to recognise their changed ownership.
Yeah.
I'm not sure whether that was directly connected with that. It's only a New Zealand change, but Icon have decided that they're going to go with Roadshow now for their New Zealand theatrical distribution. And so I saw a whole lot of films on the calendar just change the dates, that everything stayed the same except the name of the distributor. Are we worried? Should we be worried? Because Roadshow do have a bit of a reputation for not having that much confidence in some of their smaller films.
Look, I think that stuff ebbs and flows. It's interesting at the moment. I think there's going to be, you know, a good number of titles coming out of Roadshow that will get released that maybe in the past might not have, I don't know. But and there's a number of factors that go into their decisions about that. You know, some of it's to do with what they can actually do, generate revenue out of the whole life of the film and every stage of the film, so to speak, you know, theatrical, TV, DVD, all the rest of it, and how, and so there are often factors that come into their thinking, not just the pure theatrical release. Icon have, you know, like in some of the stuff I've read, they've really said that this is to do with getting closer to their partner in terms of the DVD side of the business, and the Roadshow, one of the main players for releasing content on DVD, and it just made sense to sort of be closer to them.
So it sounds like theatrical is not even that much of a priority for them.
Oh, it is. No, it is. You can't have a successful DVD release without a successful theatrical release. I mean, the two go hand in hand. The bigger the film opens theatrically, the more value it occurs with the DVD, and the more, you know, the marketing is done to a large extent. So no, they go hand in hand. But I think, you know, I mean, I think Roadshow are pretty excited about it. I think they're pretty, they're really pleased to have.
It's a good slate.
It is a good slate.
And it was always the most interesting part of the Hoyt / Studio Canal slate anyway. So, I mean, I wonder what it means for them.
Well, I think Studio Canal have got a lot more coming too. Right. So I think that...
So it makes room.
Yeah, I think it's sort of, you know, it could suit both parties reasonably well, I think. I mean, because Studio Canal, I think, are going to have a lot more product coming through. And they are Studio Canal are really art sort of, or tend to be a lot of art content that comes through them,
right?
Interesting though. It is interesting how these things chop and change and they're shifting.
Yeah.
And it does highlight, I guess, that they're all looking at ways to be more efficient and to better ways to affect their bottom line and so on.
Yeah. A couple of weekends ago, I was up in Auckland at the Big Screen Symposium, and one of the sessions there was about the distribution for Mount Zion, and the producer of that film was there, and also from Sony, Andrew Cornwell. Yeah, yep. From Sony was there, and it was very interesting how open he was about the finances around that and about the investment that was put in to that, and he talked about how, from his point of view, how much a film has to gross before it's likely to actually produce a return, and he was talking about upwards of $1 million New Zealand for him to consider putting Sony's weight behind a New Zealand film. So, you know, there were a lot of people in that session who were perhaps interested in approaching one of the majors who about distributing their locally made feature, who would have had their had those hopes dashed slightly because you know, we're seeing a lot of the local product come through Madman or through Rialto, because they can handle those smaller products more carefully and more niche, whereas somebody like Sony, you know, they want, it's only worth their while. Interesting, he talked about the amount of advertising, their marketing spend on Mount Zion was something like $240,000, you know, which seemed like an extraordinary amount of money to me, but then I don't know how much it costs to advertise on the back of a bus. And
I think if you're doing TV as well, that comes into the mix quite, you know, that's quite a big chunk.
Yeah.
I think they all work on different models, and so relative to their model, that's what they've got to achieve to, you know, their whole infrastructure and what they've got to achieve to sort of make a margin out of it. And then you look at, you know, smaller distributors who don't have the same sort of models and will try and release those films. Yeah, I mean, it is. And I think the studios are always used to releasing these big sort of monster films, you know, Wolverine and things like that, and that's the kind of what that's their
bread and butter,
that's what they know.
Yeah, and also those are the budgets that they're used to dealing with as well, because for something like that, you know, the marketing spend on something like Wolverine will be up more like $400,000.
You know? Yeah, well, what is it when you do a $100 million film? You know, it's what, 50 million or whatever it is. There's a huge chunk of it that goes into the marketing in terms of how they release, you know, films worldwide. It is. I'm always staggered at how much they allocate for that.
Yeah.
And then you've got all the other costs, like, you know, if you've got one of the big stars, I mean, what, you know, 50 million?
Yeah, well, this is the thing.
Taking for it, you know, like.
I mean, all of these numbers are quite staggering in terms of the number of zeros that we're talking about. And I think that this is, it's helpful for people who complain about films either being released or not being released, or how films are marketed, or even to an extent, and this will actually feed into the next topic that we're going to talk about, which is Elysium, is how films actually end up, like what the actual finished product is, because once you get to a certain amount of investment, it dictates the way a film is actually going to be finished, or the kind, or a script, even. You know, you go, okay, well, once it used to be Russell Crowe, you know, well, once we've got Russell Crowe in our film, then we've got to change the script to suit him, to suit the expectations. You know, he's going to cost us $25 million, therefore our budget's now doubled, and therefore our film has to change. And is that right? I mean, let's talk about Elysium, because I think that it's an interesting illustration.
I need to get to Elysium.
Whoever has this has the power to override their whole system.
Hey, bring down the boom saw!
This ain't gonna kill me.
You can save everyone.
We're gonna break into the most heavily guarded place in the universe.
Oh, yeah.
Interestingly, in a 2-minute and 20-second trailer, that's the only dialogue. I actually found all the dialogue that I could for that film, and which indicates to me the importance of international markets. And in, you know, when it comes to selling a big movie like a big special effects driven movie like this, that how important it is to for it to work in all of those parts of the world that don't speak English. You've seen it.
Mm-hmm.
You saw it before. You saw it, managed to see it before I did. You were skiting about this last week.
Yeah, I saw it a wee while ago.
Yeah. So what did you think? Tell us first of all, what's it about?
Well, it's for fans of District 9. In some ways, it's a similar sort of premise. You know, it's the haves and the have-nots, and Matt Damon plays this kind of. I think he's an orphan in the film, and he has got a sort of checkered past, a bit of crime on the side. But then when you look at the options available to people on Earth, that's pretty much it. Or working in a really low level menial job, which he is now doing. It does flash back a bit in terms of his relationship with a young woman who they were both orphaned together, and I think they were nuns, weren't they, looking after them?
Yeah.
And it's that sort of premise where, you know, they have a strong bond, a romance, whatever, they grow up together.
But they're separated
and they're separate.
Life.
Yeah, that's right, and life treats them badly. And
he's trying to turn the page, though, isn't he? He's been a bit of a crook. He's, you know, done a few sort of dodgy things, but he's trying to toe the line. But there's a scene in there where, you know, his mouth gets the better of him, and
he's got a bit of
cop.
Yeah. And there's some great scenes with the robot cop and with his the guys that
parole officer.
You know, I thought that was
the world that's been created.
This
is
horribly
really
automated world, which has no compassion and is ruled by Elysium, which is this big sort of beast of a ship that is Bliss and circles the planet and looks down on these guys for natural resources and labor. And that. You know, is the world that he is in, and it's not a very nice one. And of course, you know, what's going on in Elysium is a bit of a power struggle, and Jodie Foster, who's pretty flat in this film. You know, she's not. Yeah, I found her character probably one of the least likable in the film, just because she didn't really give much. She didn't really. She was very cold, and maybe that's, you know, she was just trying to play a cold, ruthless type of.
Sort of Thatcherite, sort of steely. Politician, you know, but a sort of fascist politician, as opposed to the, you know, the president of Elysium, who's a little bit more sort of kind,
a bit more humane, isn't he? And so there's a conflict going on Elysium for who's going to gain power, and if she's the Minister of Defence, and so she's sort of plotting a coup, and at the plant where Matt Damon works is the guy who runs the plant is in cohorts with her, and they're going to basically. Take over the network and rule Elysium.
They're going to reboot the machine.
That's right, reboot it all.
The system.
And of course, what happens is Matt Damon is working on this gear, and he gets irradiated, basically. He gets locked in because he's not worth much and they don't really care, and get in there and fix it, and it doesn't matter what
happens
to him.
Disposable.
Yeah, very disposable. And he has a very limited time to live. And so he needs to get to Elysium, because of course Elysium is where you can, you know, you get cancer, whatever.
They've got these amazing machines that can cure anything.
Anything, that's right. And so
you'd be there in a heartbeat, Kaylee, wouldn't you?
Your
viruses, your bugs,
everything.
Yeah, just gone. And so it's got this great Medicare system.
Yeah. But only if you're one of the chosen few.
That's right. And so he's trying to get up there to to break in and basically save his life. Of course, to do this, he needs they want to kidnap the boss and use him as leverage to do that. And what happens when they kidnap the boss is that there's a transfer of information between Matt Damon and him, which gives all the detail of how to bring the network down. And
this is where it starts to get a bit silly, isn't it?
To reboot. Elysium, and this is where it does kind of, it to me, it departs at that point quite a bit from District 9, and it's more of a standard sci-fi type romp, and
it's like Hackers,
but it's also
just a classic. I've got something. Everybody else is after me because I've got it, and I've got to use that information it sets up a race against time. But this idea, you know, nowadays these things, you know, it used to be that it was a folder full of stuff that needed to be photocopied, and now in the digital age, you know, it's a hard drive or a computer chip, and now it's in his brain. There's a direct sort of brain to brain connection through some dodgy USB sort of looking thing,
which is what I actually want. I've been wanting one of these for a long time. It's like, if I could just have this like computer in my brain, this chip, so I could print things out that I think of.
Right.
Really handy.
It would be, but it's you know, how do you section off which bits are important and which bits aren't? You know, the moment you have a little USB connector in your brain, so yes, you can send stuff direct to a printer, brilliant. But also somebody else could plug in and read all of your special secret thoughts. It would be a lot more dodgy than just having your Facebook privacy settings
need a good password.
but he is passworded, isn't he? The information that's been downloaded into his brain can't come out without killing him.
Mm.
Except other people are able to read it. Everyone.
There
is some silliness.
Yeah. But there's also another, storyline going on where the young woman that he grew up with is now a nurse and has a daughter, and the daughter has leukemia. And it does, in a lot of ways, it goes back to District 9 and that part of the film where it's about self-sacrifice, and you've got the self-centered character who wants to save his own life, who eventually kind of does the right thing. And I think, well, not necessarily, I don't know if District 9, he was that self-centered, but he was very bureaucratic. But they're similar in a lot of ways. And I thought that was one of the better parts of the film, the way that was handled. But then it does just go down the path of kind of action and
the whole final third of the film basically is your bog standard chase action fights, blowing stuff up. And that was the big disappointment for me.
Even to the point that Kruger, I guess there's a spoiler alert, because Kruger, who's played by Charlotte Copley, he was in District 9. He was the lead in District 9. He's still very good in this. Mm. I like watching him on the screen. He needed something. Well, I thought he didn't have enough to get his teeth into, really. It was very kind of
one-dimensional character. Yeah.
And that was a shame, because I think he's much better than that. And he just played this kind of outrageously manic kind of
South African violent
guy, But his even near the end there, I guess you can't really go down the line of saying exactly what happens to him, but then to have him back again.
Yeah, well, this is what got me about this, and sometimes you watch a film and you're not disappointed, and you don't enjoy it very much, but it hasn't raised your anticipation to quite the same degree. Mm. Whereas this one sort of actually made me quite angry by the end, because the world that they've created is so interesting and has so much potential and has so much interesting allegorical potential and, genuinely interesting sci-fi in there. And then the final third of it is just your bog standard blowing stuff up. And I realize that I'm tired of films where the resolution happens through violence. They have a fight, and whoever wins the fight will win the film. And I really wanted that something clever to happen, for somebody to use their brain to actually solve the challenge of the film.
Mm.
And I was like, I've just seen so many fights this year. Wolverine was all fights.
There's no surprises in it.
No.
There's none whatsoever. I mean, it has an interesting premise, but then it loses its way from that.
Does, yeah.
And then it's kind of like, well, we know what's going to happen next. I mean, I've seen, I quite happily sat through it and felt that it wasn't a waste of time. And I like watching, I think Matt Damon is really good in it. And I like watching him, in this film. I mean, he's always pretty good in most of the films he does. And
it's
so
a bit disappointing, isn't it, that he's basically the only white guy left on Earth. And he's the one that, I know they've given him a Latino name, Da Costa, right? So the implication is that the whites have elevated themselves up to Elysium, and Los Angeles is full of the leftovers. But if ever there was a film that demanded a non-white lead character, this could have been a Denzel Washington or somebody like that, like it really needed somebody of color rather than, I love Matt Damon, but I just think he was the wrong guy for this part.
Yeah, I don't know. I kind of wonder who would be the right guy, even though I've got to say, when I originally thought about this film, I did think that old Charlotte would be the lead.
Mm.
He could carry it off. I mean, he's a great, I reckon he's awesome.
That accent,
Wow,
he can do lots of different accents.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Like the South African accent, I just could not handle it.
But it comes back to what you were saying earlier, that this probably was a script, and it might have even had him in mind for it.
Yeah.
And then the cash is coming in, and the decision is being made.
And somebody says,
we need, boom, it's gonna, this guy.
Exactly. It's going to cost us $50 million or $75 million or $100 million to build the world digitally that you want to create. As soon as that those sorts of numbers start getting thrown around, then it becomes we need a movie star, which means we're going to need Matt Damon, and then the film goes off into it, becomes a different film, doesn't it? And I just wonder whether this is, you know, the democratization of all of the special effects and digital future. We desperately need. And I sort of thought it was happening with District 9. I thought, because that came out of left field completely, and it created this fantastic world, and it was all made in South Africa and New Zealand, and, you know, it bypassed Hollywood altogether, didn't have stars, and yet he's been absorbed into the machine, you know, and it's a real disappointment. I just hope that vision of his, he can break free and actually do stuff that isn't just this Hollywood by the numbers.
Because I mean, I think you look at District 9, you look at the level of control over that and the creative decisions, and then you look at this and you think, well, something has gone skewer for along the way, you know, and that's, it's a real shame, but it's probably, you know, for these, you know, for this director and co, a bit of a lesson.
Yeah, maybe. Kaylee, you apart from the accent, what did you think?
I actually really enjoyed it. I haven't seen District 9 yet, but I have seen Staying Alive in Joburg, which is sort of the short film preempt to District 9. I really enjoyed it. I was totally involved in it the whole time. It did get a bit actiony. Like, the fight scenes kind of put me off, because before it was sort of this intelligent sci-fi thing building this really interesting world and as you said, all these interesting allegories to immigration and apartheid and all these other things that District 9 touched on as well. But then it just sort of went meh.
Yeah.
But that being said, really enjoyable. I highly recommend seeing it. And I'm really looking forward to what he comes out with next, because is this his second feature?
Just second feature,
yeah.
And he's got a lot of talent.
That's a serious amount of talent. Like, this is someone to really look out for, and keep watching his stuff. So, yeah, break away from the man.
Yeah, exactly. And that's which is kind of the lesson of the film. Two words?
My two words will be weird science.
Okay. And Simon?
Plugged in Damon.
Okay, good stuff. Mine is sadly epic disappointment.
Oh. You know, I've often wondered why it is we have children. And the conclusion I've come to is we want someone to get it right this time. But not me. Personally speaking, I can't wait to watch life tear you apart.
Stoker.
There's a few mother-daughter issues.
It's Lady Hamlet. It's Hamlet, but Hamlet's a little Australian girl.
If you're interested in Stoker and some more information about the production of it, go back to last week's episode of the show where I talked to the director of the film, Park Chan-wook. But right now, we're going to throw this one to Kaylee, who is still in slight recovery mode after watching Stoker.
Yeah, I've had a big week this week. I've watched You're Next, followed by Elysium, followed by Stoker. So I'm a bit traumatized. I'm living by myself at the moment in a house. It's a bit scary. And I usually get home after dark because it's winter.
And have you got a piano?
No.
No, well, you get your own.
But I do have a pretty good belt collection.
Oh, okay.
So yes, as we said, we're talking last week, it marks the English language debut feature of Korean director Park Chan-wook, starring Mia Wasikowska as India, as the daughter of her father dies in a car accident. And a mysterious uncle who she's never heard of or heard from before comes to live with her and her mother. Her mother's played by Nicole Kidman, and the creepy, creepy uncle is played by Matthew Good. What else has he been in?
Brideshead Revisited, the film.
He's been in a few things, though.
Yeah, he's, and often as the the sort of the handsome lead rather than the the creepy.
He was in Point
Eminent
Match Police. Point, wasn't he?
Was he? I can't remember.
Played the brother of the love interest.
Right. Yeah, but he's reasonably well known. But this is definitely playing against type.
Yes. Mm. So, without giving too many spoilers away, the most we can say is he integrates himself into the family and
with ease.
With ease.
Yes.
He sort of eases himself in, and there's a bit of a love connection happening between the mother, him and the mother, and then also between the daughter, India. And things get weird from there.
They do. And this is, like you said earlier on, when I first heard about this project with the name Stoker, I thought, oh, this must be some connection with Bram Stoker and vampires, etc.
But the title, the writer of the script, the actor from Prison Break, whose name I can't remember right now.
Wentworth something.
Wentworth Miller?
Yeah.
I think. Yeah, it is a reference to Bram Stoker, but there's no vampires.
No, but there is definitely a creepy country house.
This is probably one of the creepiest films I've seen in a really long time. Like, edge of your seat, like, oh, what's going on? Because it just, it's one of those things where it keeps you guessing and you sort of know, but you don't know. Like, you really don't know.
It's for me, it's one of the most consciously made films. Like, you really, this is where I had a problem with it, I think, is because I never quite got engaged with the characters and sucked into the world of it, because I was really, really conscious of how careful everything was, that I was carefully constructed everything was on screen, whether it was the colors that had been chosen or the framing. And I know that that's this director, that's what he does. He is an absolute artiste down to almost the pixel.
And the actors look like they're porcelain, like their skin is just perfect and very pale and very like nouveau riche. Like,
it felt perfect. Kind of soulless or heartless and very much like a director, and in a kind of Hitchcockian way, and which is fair enough because Hitchcock is definitely an influence on this film. But they're kind of like chess pieces being moved around by an all powerful director. And
but so it feels very almost traditional cinema, like very. It's of a bygone time, isn't it? And it's very classical the way that it looks. I mean,
There's no improvisation in this. We'll just busk it and see what happens. This is absolutely planned out to the nth degree, and it felt a little bit cold to me.
Yeah, I found that it worked. Although I really enjoy films like that. It reminded me of like films by Todd Solondz, where you have that very specific palette and those very specific moves and very specific framing it's not classical framing. It's a bit off-putting because the heads are a bit too low and there's a lot of wall in the background, a lot of like blank or like single color space. But I really like that. Like, that's what really drew me in. But it was also, it did overtake the story sometimes. Like, at times it felt more, there was more style than substance. Once you get to the end and the mystery is sort of coming together, it's a bit more. But it is quite a simple story wrapped up in this very, very beautiful package that's immaculately wrapped with a bow. And like,
yeah. That's right. Exactly. And you know what you're describing there is normally the kind of thing that I really go for too. Mm. You know, it's like I was quite excited about this because I thought, I mean, I love filmmakers who are totally in command of their material, you know, who are totally in control. And yet this time around it felt a little bit too controlled. I felt like I was too conscious of the pieces being moved around the board. So a little bit of a disappointment for me. But I do know film fans, and if you are a cinephile, and of course if you're listening to the show, then you fit that bill, I would imagine, then you are going to get a kick out of Stoker. You'll certainly not want to miss it, just because it's going to be one that people are going to talk about for a long time, I think. And you know, it's worth seeking out on the big screen. It's one of those films that's going to look, if you can find it in a decent sized screen DCP presentation, it showcases DCP. You know, if you watched it on 35mm, the flicker and the grain and the dirt and what have you, it would actually detract from the beautiful, pristine framing and colors. You know, you wouldn't want to watch this on an old print.
No.
You know, you'd want to watch this on a brand new print where the colors are just popping.
Yeah.
You should seek it out, definitely.
But it's an interesting choice for Nicole Kidman. And she's very, I mean, even though she's so incredibly tense and bizarre, she is amazing to watch.
She's making some really good and interesting choices.
I know, because I mean, that's the second one now that I've recently that I've seen her in. I mean, I saw her in The Railway Man, and you know, not to say too much about it, but another really good choice. And because I'm not a fan, I haven't been a fan of hers for a while, and now though I've seen these two films lately, and I think, gee, you know, she's really kind of bringing it on. Like,
and there's
it's
another
really
film,
good.
another film of hers that came out last year that, or didn't come out here, but somehow missed festivals and didn't come out, which is The Paperboy, which sounded really interesting and sounded like a really brave choice on her part. And maybe that's a film that may get some attention now that the director Lee Daniels is being talked about as an Oscar contender for The Butler. But yes, I think she is making, maybe it's an age thing. It's like you get to a point where you're not a leading lady anymore. The scripts that are coming across your desk, You feel like an obligation to be more adventurous than previous. But
and yeah. I think her face is relaxed a little bit from all the surgery, so she can move her face a bit more. Like in Australia, her face didn't move. Come on. But I mean, you know, she has a lot of close ups in this film, and you can tell she's had work done, but she does look good.
Okay. All right. Well, let's sum this sucker up. Stoker, who wants to start?
I'm not gonna give two words for this today.
You're not?
No.
You're just withdrawing.
Mm.
Okay. Okay.
I don't even
know. How about with this one? I'm going to say fans only.
What about Icebox?
Oh, yeah. Ooh. Good. See, now you got one. Oh,
just took me away. Just took me away.
I can't. I'm still traumatized.
Still. How about that? Still traumatized.
Put a lock on your door.
Two word review. Okay. Time for some news.
And the worst thing is, I went, like, when I got home, I went to the kitchen, there's a spider on the counter. This is my life. Author and sometime screenwriter Elmore Leonard passed away this week from stroke complications. He was 87 years old. His stories inspired films like 3:10 to Yuma, Get Shorty, and Jackie Brown. His 10 rules for writing are now famous, and Cinematica's favorite is number 10, try to leave out the part that readers tend to skip.
Yep, wise words, Elmore.
Mm.
And yeah, worth checking out all 10 of those online. Maybe we'll stick a link in the show notes. And yeah, very sad day, really, for lovers of great sort of pulp fiction, but also cinema.
Mm. The New York Film Festival has announced its main slate of 35 features, and while there's quite a bit of crossover from the most recent NZ International Film Festival, titles we missed out on include James Gray's The Immigrant and the Coens' Inside Llewellyn Davis, Ralph Fiennes plays Charles Dickens and directs in The Invisible Woman, and the new Hayao Miyazaki, which is breaking box office records in Japan, The Wind Rises. The New York Film Festival is presented by the Film Society of Lincoln Center and starts on September 27th.
And we're getting to that time of year where the big North American festivals are competing with each other for the big names for Oscar contention. So Toronto insists that all films be North American premieres, and so they've got their sort of choices locked away, including Long Walk to Freedom and August Osage County. And New York tries to get in a little bit earlier. And some interesting ones in there, including the James Franco film, Child of God.
American Hustle, man.
I'm not sure if that's in... American Promise is there. All Is Lost, which is a film that I'm really looking forward to seeing, which is the follow-up to J.C. Chandor's film Margin Call, which is Robert Redford alone in a yacht.
Yeah, which looks really interesting.
Looks really
like
good,
that.
Doesn't
look
it?
At that.
And what else have we got here for New York, which I'm really
Philomena, are they playing that?
No, I suspect not. But Nebraska, Alexander Payne's new film, which I'm also really keen to see.
Walter Mitty,
is in the New York Film Festival. I think it's going to get its world premiere at New York. But yeah, lots of films that played in Wellington and Auckland. So you know, if you feel like you had a good run at the New Zealand International Film Festival, probably you could you don't need to jump on a plane to New York because you know there'll be a few double ups.
And it's and it's sold out.
Maybe not.
I don't know. But, you know, just in case somebody does go.
No, it's they've only just gone on sale, so okay, you know, right, probably good. Still don't.
Maybe buy your film festival tickets first.
But they do, but for the Film Society of Lincoln Center is where the festival is organized and where the screenings happen, and they don't have anything. I mean, it's pretty flash, but it's not the Civic, you know. There's still some benefits to being down under.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In other festival news, Venice has announced that it is awarding the prestigious Glory to the Filmmaker Prize to writer-director Ettore Scola. The Venice Film Festival starts in about a week's time.
The only reason I dropped that news in there is because I thought that it's like the best name for a prize ever.
Glory to the filmmaker.
Glory to the filmmaker. I think we should have a Glory to the Podcaster prize, and we should award it to ourselves.
Glory. Glory be.
And also in other film festival news, we tweeted today, volunteer applications are now open for Sundance. So if you want to volunteer at Sundance, and if you have a big winter coat...
And you can read a seat number.
Yeah.
Do you actually get to see much when you're a volunteer at Sundance?
You do.
You get to sit there and watch them. Well, you're doing the New Zealand one, don't you, if you're an usher?
Yeah, but there's all sorts of different kinds of volunteers at Sundance. You know, there may be stuff that doesn't actually get you into a cinema.
You could be the salt shoveler.
Yeah. Two friends of mine who live here in New Zealand volunteered last year and went over, and they watched quite a few films. But it is very competitive for early morning screenings, because screenings started around 8 a.m. It does mean lining up at like 6 in the morning to get in and get your tickets. And if you have a volunteer pass, there's a special line for you, and you have to wait till the VIP members, if they want to get in, though, they have to be there 30 minutes beforehand, and then tickets go on sale for other people. And very, very different festival world. So if you're interested in working there, I highly recommend it. You should go.
Yeah, at least once. All right, back to the movies.
Duncan, on a scale of 1 to 10, what do you think you are?
A 6.
I think you're a 3. Since I've been dating your mom, I don't see you putting yourself out there, bud. You can try to get that score up at my beach house this summer.
This in all his awkward glory.
This is my son, Duncan.
I was going to name my youngest Duncan, but we went with Peter. Finally, fixed his lazy eye. Now it's even worse.
Duncan, if we were going to make this work, then there has to be trust. A
king. Mom's boyfriend called me a 3. Who says that to somebody?
That's about him. It's got nothing to do with you.
How do you know?
All right, talking of Sundance, this was the big hit of Sundance this year, The Way, Way Back. And now in cinema, Simon... have you not seen it? He's shaking his head at me. I thought you had.
No, mate.
So, Kaylee, have you seen The Way, Way Back?
No, but I really want to. The next two films we're reviewing, I really want to see, but I haven't had a chance to see.
I have seen it.
Oh, that's a relief, isn't it?
That could have been a bit embarrassing. Because you suggested it.
Oh, it's got to be reviewed.
Okay, well, look, we'll just...
Yeah, shit, mate. It's got to be done.
That's what the executive producer does.
Look.
It has to be done.
It's got to be reviewed because people love it, and they come out of the film buzzing, and there's not a bad word to say. So right. I think...
okay, well, it's just a quickie then.
You can muse as long as you like, Dan.
Well, I will, but you know how I don't really love the sound of my own voice.
What?
So, The Way, Way Back, it's a pretty much a bog-standard coming-of-age story set in the present day in Long Island and the Hamptons. And a young chap called Duncan is being dragged away to the summer house of the boyfriend of his mother with his daughter as well. So the four of them are trapped in this car, and they're on their way to what should be, if the relationship between all of the parties wasn't so tense, it could have been a lot of fun. Anyway, Steve Carell plays the boyfriend and Toni Collette plays the mother. And I was a bit put off almost instantly when I saw the two of them in the car, because it reminded me of the... what was that?
Little Miss Sunshine.
Little Miss Sunshine, right? Which had both of those in it and which I... detested with passion. I hated Little Miss Sunshine, and I felt I was being manipulated every single step of the way. So it took me a while to get over that. in The Way, Way Back, which does similar sorts of things. It does, you know, it's sort of equally manipulative, but has a lot more charm, a lot more genuine charm, partly due to Sam Rockwell, who is always watchable on screen and is very, very funny in this film. And he plays the guy who owns and manages the local water park.
That would be quite cool, I must say.
Yeah.
Wouldn't mind.
And he's obviously inherited it.
Be high, though.
He's inherited it from his family, and he's not really that into actually doing any work. He just sort of likes to hang around in this in the summer and watch the people that he employs do all of the work. And he befriends this lonely kid who tries to escape the tension of the house on a daily basis. And an unlikely friendship develops between these two, and it's really about Sam Rockwell's character and the characters at the water park bringing the kid out of himself, Duncan out of himself, and you know giving him a sense that you know things may not be all that bad after all. So it is quite nice. It does create a really good sense of place and time. You know, like buy into the world that's created. I just felt like we've seen this, you know, over and over again. This sort of
I love these films.
Nerdy, but I tell you what,
Did you see? I'm going to do a segue here. Mm. Did you see The Spectacular Now at the film festival?
Yes.
Did you feel manipulated through that as well?
Pretty much. Yeah.
but I love it.
But yeah. But you know, there's manipulation and there's manipulation. I guess you know and. Whereas in this film, I think my problem really is that it's so much from the lonely, geeky boy's perspective that all of the women characters they're not real people. You know, even the girl next door who he sort of gets a crush on, played by Anna Sophia Robb, the mother of the girl next door, the best friend who hits on Steve Carell's character. Like none of these people are real people. Not the women, you know, it's all, you know, all of the effort goes into trying to create a truthful, authentic, nerdy, geeky boy, because that's, you know, it's usually some kind of autobiography going on there, isn't there? Let's be honest. It just seems a bit unfair, you know, that all of that energy would go into one character who we've seen over and over again over the last 40 years. And I'd like really love to see one of these films from the female point of view, or at least have a better balance, you know. All of these characters, it's all about what they do for this kid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's only a kid. He's not that interesting, really, you know. The other characters are more interesting. So I just felt a little bit like, I've seen it all before. It's got some nice aspects to it. There's certainly some winning performances, and it certainly didn't wind me up the way that Little Miss Sunshine did. And a nice sort of indie soundtrack to it. We played a track from Edie Brickell at the end of last week's show. So, yes, I know it's people will be rewarded by it. You will be entertained by it. And I know John Davies, who we've had on the show as a guest when he was the manager of and owner of the Academy Cinemas, he just absolutely adores this film, loves it, and he's doing reviews on the radio now. He's a critic. I know. We should get him back on the show as a reviewer.
Yeah.
But he absolutely loved it and was very disappointed when he found out that I didn't. So you know, people have this emotional connection to it that I wasn't able to make, unfortunately.
It seems like our really nice film of the week. Like this week we have a good mixture of films for all different genres.
I think,
well, and this is the nice film.
And this is why we love the movies, you know, because in any given week there's something for you, isn't there? You know, whether you want loud explosions or Matt Damon or whatever, or scary,
if you want
scary horror. Well, you know, it's not everybody's cup of tea.
I can't wait to have like an Elysium candelabra double feature. It's like both with Matt Damon getting like serious reconstructive surgery.
Yeah, true.
In very different ways.
True, exactly.
Yeah, one's more believable than the other.
Which one? Oh, which one?
Yes. So I'm going to give you two words for The Way, Way Back, which are forgettable charm. And Should we just check whether I'm the only person that's seen the next film on the list as well? You seen Frances Ha?
No, mate. I'm sorry.
It's just me again. I actually think we should hold off on Frances Ha until next week because...
Well, I think also Kelly and I need to go and see The Way Way Back and just come back to you and go, no, and tell me where you are so wrong. Because I've got a funny feeling we're both going to really like it, aren't we? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think that's probably true. But I really do think that Kelly is the target market for Frances Ha. I want her take on it.
You know what I did this weekend instead of going to the movies? I sewed a dress. That's what I did this weekend. I got out my sewing machine, made myself a full-on dress. So I'm afraid I'm going to watch Frances Ha and have like a total meltdown or something.
Well, this is oh what God, we want. We want you to go and report back from us. And to be honest, with Frances Ha, I saw it last year at Telluride at the world premiere. Did I mention that I was at Telluride last year? But I might need to see it again just to remind myself. It was such a long time ago. Anyway, that is our show for this week. Next week, guest reviewer Liam from Flix is going to join us to help with Mortal Instruments: The City of Bones. He's absolutely desperate. He saw it on Monday.
By Skype?
Yes, we'll be Skyping. We'll be Skyping
him.
He's not
going to be here.
I know, but he saw this Mortal Instruments on Monday night, and he was totally embargoed. They had to sign something that said he wasn't allowed to even talk about it till it opens. But he's desperate to get on the show again, so we'll be
City
doing that.
City of Bones.
The City of Bones. Mm. Yes, another one of those young adult things, but it's based on books that nobody's ever heard of. I think
one of our staff members told me today that they're upset that we're not playing it here.
Well.
What can you say?
I don't know what to say about that.
I just quietly made my coffee. I was like,
We need to go back to our policy of our employment policy. Yeah.
No talking back. No talking back on the program.
No watching Mortal Instruments. See your bones.
Also next week, Kick-Ass 2.
Yes!
And The Patient Stone. Yes. We're going to do some giveaways, which reminds me. Yes, so...
what are those giveaways, Dan?
What's in the box?
Okay, The Patient Stone. We've got some... double passes for that to give away, and also Much Ado About Nothing, which is also around. So what's the best way of doing it, seeing as you'll be the one that's monitoring the social media feeds and checking for entries? What's the best way of doing it, Kelly?
What do we have to give to them? Is it 2-for-1 passes?
No, they are actual double passes.
Double passes this week.
Yep.
If you would like a double pass to The Patient Stone or to Much Ado About Nothing, send us a tweet at CinematicaCast with the hashtag either Patient Stone or Much Ado, and let us know if you would like to have one.
Yep.
And then first in, first served.
Yeah, pretty much. And
I may ask you to answer a skill testing question or bake me cookies.
Oh, yeah, good call. And
depending where you live.
Because you know, we're completely open to all sorts of influence in that area. And, you know, these films do open soon. So, you know, in fact, tomorrow, actually. Mm-hmm. So, get in quick. Well, tomorrow when we're recording, today when you're listening to it, probably. So, a little bit of temporal confusion there. That and more in next week's exciting episode of New Zealand's favourite movie podcast, Cinematica. If you've enjoyed this episode, don't forget to click subscribe in iTunes or your own favourite podcasting software if you have an alternative, so the latest episode is always downloaded automatically. Remember your feedback at the iTunes store, those ratings, reviews, they help push us up the ladder. Always more listeners every week to the show, which we're very, very happy about. You can contact us via various social media methods and give us your feedback, your two-word reviews.
Yes, you can find us on Twitter, as we said before, via @CinematicaCast, on Facebook at facebook.com/CinematicaPodcast, on Letterboxd, where you can find our two-word reviews of the films, and as always, on our website at cinematica.co.nz.
The show is a Guns of Steel production. The theme music was 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, which you can buy at the iTunes store. We're going to leave you with some more music. This is actually from a film that we've decided not to review today, actually. second thoughts about that. Anyway, this is from Francis Ha, Georges Delarue's Camille, although this is not the famous Camille that he wrote for Godard's Contempt, which was then even more famously used in Scorsese's Casino. This is also called Camille, but I can't find out what film this is originally from. My Google foo was weak today, and I couldn't find out where it came from. Maybe you could tell us. That's it from us until next week. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
And goodbye.